Good evening, this is Dr. Dan Guerra, Authentic Biochemistry Podcast, 22 February 2024. Biochemical Mosaic number 1, chapter number 13, my favorite number. And we're going to continue our discussion of phospholipid metabolism in association with anhydrolase. Now, when we talk about phospholipid acid, you realize that there are fatty acids on the 1 and 2 position of that cholesterol backbone. So a lot of work has been done with model lipids to understand protonation and how protonation of that phosphatidic acid head group is regulated by pH, because this plays a major role within the membrane. And so one of the standard lipids that's been studied is dipalmitoyl phosphatidyl or phosphatidic acid, dipalmitoyl phosphatidic acid, also DPPA is the acronym. And it has protonation states based on what is protonated in the phosphate backbone, or in the head group, I mean. And that corresponds to low pH conditions where the head group is deprotonated, and high pH conditions where the head group is fully deprotonated. Okay? That plays a significant role in fluidity. Now, the protonation state of a compound like dipalmitoyl phosphatidic acid is acting like an organic surfactant. And what that does, the nature of an organic surfactant is control when it's associated with a membrane. Monolayer fluidity, surface organization, and overall membrane topodynamics, and therefore morphology. So the solution pKa that is generated by the different states of protonation actually determines the speciation for surfactant effectivity on that system. Okay, now, the interesting thing is pH and pKa, of course, are directly related, Henderson-Hazelbalch equation, right? But when you're talking about that pKa of a lipid acting as an organic surfactant, there's a distinction associated with whether or not that lipid is on the surface or whether or not it's in the bulk membrane matrix. Obviously, that makes things far more complicated in living systems. So when you look at the molecular area expansion at a basic pH, the pKa to remove the second proton from DPPA with a surface, that's what would be called the surface pKa2, right? That would be that constant. At the aqueous interface, it is easy to detect. And a condensed DPPA monolayer has a surface pKa2 of about 11.5. But now that will be altered by the presence of course, counterions like sodium, particularly sodium in the aqueous subphase. So that's going to reduce the resultant apparent pKa2 from that 11.5 down to 10.5. So that surface pKa2 value of DPPA is also modulated by another biochemical, biophysical property, and that's the packing density. And that's because of the alteration of surface charge density. And in fact, the surface charge density in an intact membrane is what drives alterations in the surface pKa. So there is a diffuse double layer of ions consisting of counterions and then co-ions, that means of the same charge, that are going to be embedded within a dielectric medium directly within the membrane. And that's going to generate a Poisson distribution. So not only are you going to have different apparent pKas, even of something simple like phosphatidic acid, but the pKa that's actually being registered in the membrane is going to change according with solvent conditions within that membrane because of the aqueous phase and its alteration of miscibility within that dynamic system. So you can understand now the complexity, even at just the organic chemical level, is far more complex than what we normally talk about in biochemistry. Also keep in mind that the charges of the various phospholipids change with the polar head group. Remember that phosphatidic acid can be converted to CDP, diacylglycerol. Also, PA can be converted to diacylglycerol. That is, of course, via the phosphatidic acid hydrolase or lipid. But the diacylglycerol also can be converted to triacylglycerol. You know, too, that DAG can be converted directly to PC and PE. And the DAG can be reconverted to PA via DAG kinase. And TAG can also lose a fatty acid, reform DAG, and then DAG goes back to PA. It's a very dynamic system. All that activity can occur in the membrane. Now, if you're talking about CDP diacylglycerol synthesis, which that's the nucleotide pathway, we talked about it already, remember that's going to generate phosphatidylserine, which then can be decarboxylated to form phosphatidylethanolamine. Now, depending on the fluid dynamics and that pKa for protonation of the head group, phosphatidylserine normally is going to act as a monovalent anion because you have one of the oxygen atoms generating a formal negative charge, phosphate generating a negative charge, but the amino group is going to give you a positive charge. It's going to give you a minus one total. But now when you get the conversion of PS to PE via the decarboxylation, you lose that carbonyl. So you lose a negative charge. So now PE can function, as I told you at the beginning of these lectures, as a Zwitter ion, generating sort of a neutral system, right? And if PE is methylated, trimethylated, of course, using S-N-S-methionine, you're not going to change the ionic character there. You are going to change the hydrophobicity of the lipid because of the three methyl groups. But basically, PC can function within the membrane also with a neutral Zwitter ionic character. Now, when you start talking about CDP-DAG being used for phosphatidylinositol, phosphate biosynthesis, then you can generate a far more elaborate negative charge because of the increase in phosphorylation, right? Remember, PIP to PIP2 to PIP3. That's going to give you a totally different series of properties in terms of the fluidity of the membrane. What's interesting about phosphatidylinositols, not only do they harbor and therefore maintain the potential for a stronger negative charge for that phospholipid in situ in the membrane, that lipid is also highly volatile in terms of its reactivity because we have the phosphatidylinositol cascade, which can completely remove the inositol, right? And so, or leave a phosphate such that you will regenerate phosphatidic acid or diacylglycerol in the membrane. Now, if you synthesize diacylglycerol in the membrane, that could often then activate protein kinase C, which will turn on its own unique signal transduction cascade along with the inositol phosphate generated, which normally can work through calcium channel modulation and kinases that also function directly from the inositol. And those inositol-associated kinases can turn on enzymes like AKT, which can then go on to potentially regulate mTORC. Okay? So you've got this phospholipid chemistry going on in the membrane, which alters the protein component and the lipid component, therefore the signaling from exterior to interior to the cell. Then you've got all this dynamic for the potential for alteration of those phospholipids, which occurs according to a modulated induction of change of activity relative to things like G-protein coupled receptors. But also that will lead to a change in the fluidity of the membrane because of the charge density distributional changes. Okay. So that gives you, I think, a larger picture. Now, lipids like phosphatidic acid are involved directly with bonding to many other effector molecules, such as other lipids or at proteins, as we've talked about just last lecture. So the binding is directly related to the membrane availability, and thus what can be described as a concentration dependent mechanism, because altering membrane availability changes the relative concentration of phosphatidic acid in the membrane. And that availability is controlled by the interaction of the phosphatidic acid to the cytoskeletal proteins, which can neutralize its charge. So the modification of membrane lipid species via enzymatic turnover adds an entirely new motif. So think about phospholipase D. Think about diacylglycerol kinase, right? Phospholipase D, right, is going to generate phosphatidic acid, but diacylglycerol kinase will also generate it. And those two enzymes are active in situ. And they are not negatively regulated with each other. Okay? Because that's going to be coupled to all this upstream signaling, which is going to go back to being linked to membrane fluid dynamics, what I call topodynamics, right? So phosphatic acid in the membrane is usually very low. We talked about this many times. And the reason it's low when you just do a compositional analysis is because it's converted to all those other lipids, including, remember, you're getting polyunsaturated fatty acid turnover from phospholipase A2 activity, generating lysophospholipids. And, you know, that's going to turn on an entirely new nested set of signal transduction cascades, which are called receptor tyrosine kinases. Okay? Now, I've talked about those in the past, those RTKs, but there's yet another single transduction cascade. So phospholipase D will generate phosphatidic acid signaling. So PLD, potent regulator of RAS signaling, which is, of course, associated with oncogenesis, because it regulates cell proliferation, differentiation, but also apoptosis. So epidermal growth factor stimulation results in an increased activity at the membrane of PLD. And that will be involved in the generation of localized, what I just talked about, phosphatidic acid. That can lead to the binding and recruitment of an effector protein called 7-lis. Son of 7-lis is the exact name for it. I'm not going to go into the detail of why it's named that after the Drosophila mutant, but I do know that story. But son of 7-lis, or the SOS protein, then changing recruitment because of phosphatidic acid generation will lead to directly RAS activation. RAF1 is activated too by PA, generated by PLD. And RAF1, along with the RAS that we haven't gone through all this, the nomenclature yet, but RAF1, another polypeptide, will then be involved in the activation of downstream mitogen activated protein kinase, the MAP kinase pathways. Now, all of this is oncogenic. I'm sure cancer biologists are well aware of this when I'm bringing up these. The names of these enzymes, right? These kinases. So PA can bind and activate the mammalian target of mTOR, of rapamycin, excuse me. So you remember that from previous lectures. And you know that mTOR is what? A protein kinase. Okay. That's also associated with cancer and just generally anabolism. Now you also have a sphingosine kinase. It's significant in cellular growth, calcium homeostasis, and cellular movement. And it's regulated by PLD and phosphatidic acid-dependent recruitment to the intracellular membrane. That is the sphingosine kinases, okay? Making sphingosine 1-phosphate. So you have three different phospholipases, PLA1 removing the fatty acid from the one position, PLA2 removing the fatty acid from the two position, then PLD making phosphatidic acid, and PLC making dot, 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 diacylglycerol. Okay. Keep that in mind because it's very important. All right. Now, let's talk about PLD in more detail. PLD catalyzes the hydrolysis of lipids like phosphatidylcholine. Phosphatidylcholine, very prominent, very common, very high mole percent in the membrane. That can generate a lot of phosphatidic acid and consequently activate that signaling cascade we just got involved talking about. Now, there are two mammalian isoforms of PC-specific PLD. These are PLD1 and 2. And even though they have structural similarities and amino acid sequence similarities, the modes of activation and their precise function are quite distinct. So it's true that both PLD1 and 2 are novel target genes of the beta-catenin TCF pathway. PLD and PA are implicated indeed in a diverse range of pathophysiological processes. We've talked about these. I'll bring them up again specifically. Inflammatory responses and also endophagocytosis, oncogenesis, of course, and metastasis. So PLD has been generating a lot of interest, not only in the cell because of its activation, generating PA, but also in cancer research. So a little bit about this process. Remember that you can have growth factor or canonical WNT signaling, WNT signaling. That will induce PLD expression. And that will lead to a whole discussion of phosphatidic acid in this growth factor WNT signaling associated oncogenesis. So growth factor or mitogen-induced PLD activation induces the RAS, RAF, ERK, NF-kappa-B pathway. Or, alternatively, the RAS-PI3 kinase AKT. NF-kappa-B pathway. So two different signaling cascades, which enhance, of course, finally, the binding of NF-kappa-B to the PLD promoter. This is, of course, NF-kappa-B is transcription factor, right? So active oncogenic RAS induces the expression of PLD1 through the binding of an SP1 to the upstream PLD1 promoter, just another component of the transcription factor complex, right? So now you get increased PLD1 expression, you get high levels of PA production, and that can directly promote the invasion of cancer cells. Okay? Now, Ewing's sarcoma fusion protein, that's the EWS, will also selectively induce not PLD1, but PLD2 because of the binding to its promoter. Okay. Even in the absence of WNT, therefore, cytoplasmic beta-catenin can be phosphorylated and then subsequently turned over. So when WNT does bind to a receptor called the Frizzled receptor, you get a formation of what's known as a destruction complex. And that's inhibited and accumulated by beta-catenin being translocated to the nucleus, forming now the beta-catenin transcription factor complex that we just went through. So then PLD1 and PLD2 genes are both transcriptionally activated, because you get the binding of beta-catenin, okay? And that beta-catenin TCF transcription factor complex binds to something called the TBE, right? That's the enhancer element. And that then turns on the promoters of both PLD1 and PLD2. Then you get massive PLD-generated phosphatidic acid. But that will generate a suppression, ultimately, of the expression of a protein called ICAT, which will then inhibit the interaction of the beta-catenin transcription factor complex, followed by a promotion of Wnt, beta-catenin, TCF signaling, which will overall then ultimately upregulate the transcription of all those target genes and stimulate even more tumorigenic cell growth. Okay, I know I went over that fast, but that's just canonical Wnt signaling in association now with the lipid component, right? And that's what's new about, I think, the whole discussion here for people that normally are thinking about the proteins only, right? We're beyond just discussing proteins now. Now we're well into a discussion of phosphatidic acid mediated responses. And remember that PA hydrolase, that phosphatidic acid phosphatase or hydrolase, is going to effectively remove PA, but it's not going to take it completely out of activation circuitry because of all the possibility of regenerating PA and what PA can do for all the phospholipid pathways, which can work downstream, even directly from the PA binding to, say, specific proteins in the membrane. Okay. Now, for the next minutes we've got left, I want to talk a little bit about some clinical features here. Now, lung cancer, prominent disease with high mortality, certainly high morbidity in humans. You have two types of lung cancer. You know this, right? Small cell lung cancer and non-small cell lung cancer. Now, the NSCLC, the non-small cell lung cancer, is actually the most common. So, very unusual acronym, but it's called that because of what? Microscopy, right? And cell sorting research. But NSCLC accounts for over 80% of all lung cancer diagnosed worldwide, okay? And there is a specific adenocarcinoma, which is the NSCLC subtype known as T. So you get a progression of lung cancer associated with a complex network of all the events normally described for cell proliferation and migration. That will then lead to the invasion of surrounding tissues and off to distal tissues, which will then generate a secondary tumor. And that's why lung cancer is so deadly. Remember, it's a highly oxygenic environment there. So there's plenty of what? Molecular oxygen and plenty of oxidizable substrate, right? Glucose, fatty acid, amino acid. That's why lung cancer is so rapidly turned into a metastatic cancer. And this metastasis that normally drives the high morbidity and, of course, the mortality. So what's being mediated here is migrating cells begin to chemotaxy according to nutrient gradients, of course, and cell surface attractants. So what are they? Well, the chemiattractants include growth factors, cytokines, chemokine gradients, right? They all stimulate cell migration, but ultimately they lead to an interaction with GPCRs. So, and of course, the receptor tyrosine kinases. So regulatory protein signaling then leads to the activation of membrane-associated lipid biosynthesizing enzymes. This is the new player. New meaning, you know, for purposes of this lecture, but also came on the scene only really after the 2000s. That will, of course, altering lipid metabolism will generate intracellular, intramembranous lipid second messengers. And those then can be directly related to cell proliferation or migration and or migration. You know, some of those actually are just simply oxygenated fatty acids. We talked about this with the whole cyclooxygenase and lipoxygenase pathways. So what's left behind, though, is something we talk about as well, lysophosphatidic acid acyl transferase and diacylglycerol kinases. They lead to the formation of lysophosphatidic acid and the degradation, ultimately, of lysophosphatidylcholine. So that enzyme, the lysophosphatidic acid acyl transferase, or LPAT, will generate phosphatidic acid, right, in the endoplasmic reticulum. That will generate a series of intermediates, which will be involved now in de novo phospholipid and triacylglycerol biosynthesis. At the same time, diacylglycerol kinases and or phospholipase D-derived phosphatidic acid produced at other organelles or on the surface of the plasma membrane in exposure to the inner leaflet to the cytosol can now bind to and polymerize actin or even activate mTOR. So the phosphatidic acid stimulates lung adenocarcinoma cell migration because it involves an interaction with PA with that LPA1 receptor, lysophosphatidic acid 1 receptor, and then all downstream activation, which include the MAP kinase. That MAP kinase, key cascading event, leading to the actuation of a whole series of transcription factors, including the NF-kappa-B we talked about, which will promote proliferative and inflammatory responses. So the mitogenic agents that start the process can be growth factors, and that could be associated with then promoting the ERK12 phosphorylation cascade, ultimately inducing, along with the response mediated by the signal transduction cascade, cellular stress. That cellular stress can turn on transcription pro-inflammatory cytokines, and then that will co-stimulate P38 along with C-Jun N-terminal kinase, as a J&K, and then ultimately also the JAK-STAT pathway, which will then involve the immune response directly, okay? JAK-STAT pathway being intimately involved in the regulation of, for example, T-cell-induced pro-inflammatory cytokine production. Now, that's all generated to now stop cancer progression. But as you know, at the same time that can mitigate some killing, particularly if you get natural killer cell proliferation or cytotoxic T lymphocyte from the CD8 lineage. But if you're talking about the TH1, TH2 response, often what can occur is an annihilation of otherwise healthy cells while the proliferating tumor maintains, because of its dependency on the glycolytic pathway, its alternation of carbon sources, thus not requiring high levels of molecular oxygen, can now start inducing a proliferative escape from the TH1, TH2 activation of pro-inflammatory cytokine production. In fact, can lead to the annihilation of that by inhibiting that activity, right? By generating those peptides that bind to program cell death reception on the TH1, TH2 lineage. So then you're only left with natural killer cells and cytotoxic T lymphocytes and their proliferation that can lead with that immediate destruction of that nascent tumor. The same time that the original tumor can already be metastasizing. So you see how the immune response can quickly be overrun because of all this intracellular, intermembranous lipid signaling. And that's the key feature of lung cancer in particular. And this is all going down because of phosphatidic acid, phospholipase D activity, which we can see in kinase activity, and then the proliferation of all those phosphoglycerol lipid molecular species, which can further lead to alterations in membrane chemistry and physics, leading to changes in membrane physiology to a membrane pathophysiology because of actin binding, signaling through the cytoskeleton, and generating an activity gradient within the cell that will lead to an inhibition of immune cell responses to that particular tumor site. Okay. So that leads you, I think, completely where I want to be for the end of this lecture. Well, in fact, turns out we're almost out of time, so it's perfect. Dr. Dan Guerra, Thursday evening, 22/2/2024. Saying bye for now.